Shayna, my dear.
Christopher.
You know, this time before we begin the show, it's just you and me. I thought we could do some staff development.
Oh, excellent. My favorite, HR.
Yes, some staff development. I wanted to ask you a question just to get to know you a little bit better, you know.
So because we've only known each other now for 4 years, so that's good. That I'm glad your curiosity has finally piqued, Chris. Let's just forget you're a little late to the party and be glad you got here at all. Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, well, maybe I won't ask. So, seriously, here's my question. When you were a singer-performer, back in your singer-performer days, did you do any songwriting?
Yeah. Yeah, with the I co-wrote the song on homelessness that we turned into a music video, and that went national. So yeah, we did a little songwriting. My partner did most of the songwriting, Lori Wesley, but we co-wrote some stuff. It's not my strong suit.
Mm-hmm. Fun. Well,
what can I tell you?
Hey, I got to know you a little bit better, so I feel like we've developed our staff.
Now we're deeply connected. I feel that was the piece. That was the missing link. Now we're good. Oh my word. Welcome to What in God's Name. He's hysterical right now. And I'm Shayna Appel.
And I'm Chris Owen. We are What in God's Name, the podcast of the S1 Project. Our mission is to promote deeper and more fruitful conversations about our shared common life. And we do that and invite our listening community to join us in doing this by using the lenses of moral philosophy and humanistic theology, and in general, and where necessary, other humanistic disciplines.
The reason that we do this is to help us get beyond the stuck places that the conversations in our day and age are in. Stuck places that do not allow us to move towards finding commonality or a place of human flourishing.
Indeed, the default lenses for conversations about our shared common life, the default frameworks, are the spheres of politics disconnected from any moral considerations or visions of the good. So politics
rooted in right, wrong.
Yeah.
Us, them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yep. And economics,
which is mostly rooted in people's frustration and anger that they don't own a big enough piece of the pie.
Yeah, yeah.
You can see how neither of these contexts will get us into a good place.
We have a spinny wheel. We give it a spin at the beginning of each show. It is a piece of plywood upon which is painted 16 different core values, key ideas. They're sliced up like a piece of the pie, 16 different slices of pie. We spin the wheel. It's got a sprinkler head as a pointer. And where the pointer lands is a core value or key idea that Shayna and I riff on, a little improv.
And we love to describe the spinny wheel to our listeners so that they know that we are, in fact, dyed-in-the-wool, authentic, card-carrying members of the Swamp Yankee Collective. I can see it. I just can't read it. Okay. Two master's degrees, and I cannot read his writing.
The spinny wheel has landed on randomness and playfulness. This is a core value for our show. We talk about serious things. Whenever we're in public conversations that talk about serious things, we need to remember a certain kind of playfulness. Among other things, Shayna, it gets us out of ruts of predictability with regards to how one side responds to the other side in conversation. A little bit of randomness injects newness. We get so stuck in dead ends in public conversations, the injection of newness leads to possibility. And I think And possibility is another way to say hope. So hopefulness, I connect randomness and playfulness to hope in that sense.
Yeah, I think, I mean, randomness and playfulness invites participation.
Yeah.
Most importantly, whereas the conversations happening so often in our public square are really shutting down conversation. So yeah, randomness and playfulness, two excellent, what is the word I'm looking for? I'm not a real big cook. Ingredients, where they are two necessary ingredients for a good finished product. That tone indicates that it is time for us to switch topics and head into the focus for today's show.
Yes, we're pivoting out of the spinny wheel conversation and back to the main topic of today. Shana and I are going to continue to talk about the article by Jean Bethke Elshtain, Democratic Authority at Century's End. Our last show, we spent some time with it, and we wanted to revisit Jean Bethke Elshtain's thesis about democratic authority. What is it? Why do we need it?
I think for me, what stood out in Elshtain's argument, her thesis, was this idea that authority, rather than power to be wielded like a club, is invested in individuals by others. So others see this person's worthiness of authority. We deem a person an authority or not based on their willingness to be bound to something bigger than them. Yeah. So, you know, American values, democracy, the plight of the people, particularly the people who struggle the hardest. When we bind ourselves to those things, to God, to a fellowship, to an idea, when we bind ourselves to those things, we become about something bigger than just us. People recognize it when they see it. That's the essence of what I got from her paper. We all recognize it. We know it when we see it, and we sure as hell know it when we don't.
Yeah, that boundedness is a key concept, and thank you for reminding me and reminding our listening community of that very point. Part of how Elshtain treats this is to say that a leader who is unbound from something bigger, a vision of the good, whatever way we frame a sense of transcendence to which we ought to be bound, a leader divorced from that becomes then
Donald Trump.
Well, she doesn't use Donald Trump because the article was written in 2000.
Right, it was written in 2000, but man, she nailed him in. There's one particular paragraph where she describes what happens when somebody gets into a position of authority who is not bound by some, you know, who doesn't have the authority within.
Yeah.
And she described him to a T.
Yeah, and it's bigger than Trump, because I mean, just the simple fact that she was able to write this 24 years ago, and she cites examples from the past. Mao is her example, but there are certainly plenty of examples in the 20th century of power that is unbound. And so her claim is that if we want
to
fascists.
Have...
They're fascists. Well, and also on the left, like the illiberal left of the Soviet Union, par exemple. So it's not just... It's not just fascism. So that to me suggests that there's a human problem here. That aside. So here's a quote, Shana, just to refer to this sense of being bound, although she doesn't use the word bound in this quote. This is Elshtain's words. Unless citizens are able to repair to some shared political and normative vocabulary, a democratic society cannot sustain itself over time. So there's a couple of words in there I want to just lift up and explain a little bit, but I want to say this again because this is
good for about five shows.
That is so true. Unless citizens are able to repair to some shared political and normative vocabulary. So again, we're at words, interestingly enough. She's talking about how we talk, how we think. A democratic society cannot sustain itself over time. That last part of the sentence is pretty clear. Like, she's saying, if certain things do not obtain in our society, then it will not sustain itself over time. So what is the thing that is needed? And so let me just spend some time with this phrase, a shared political and normative vocabulary. The word normative right there could trip some people up.
Gets us into trouble. Yeah.
So what she means, when philosophers talk about normative things, normative vocabulary, a normative approach, what we are saying is vocabulary or conversation that lifts up what is good or better than other things. So think of normative. Think of that there's a standard that is being applied, that we ought to apply a standard. We make distinctions between what is lesser than and what is more than or better than. Another way to think of a normative statement is that it's an ought statement. I ought to take out the garbage later today is a normative statement because it's an assertion of value. Something will be good if I take out the garbage, which is the garbage is taken out. You know, it goes where it's supposed to go. That's a trivial example, but normative statements are of that kind. They're not simply descriptive. That would be a positive statement. That table is brown. It's not a normative statement. It's a positive statement. It asserts something simply as true, but it says nothing about value. So normative statements, normative vocabulary is about value.
And I would encourage our listeners, even as Chris is saying this, to just sort of do a little bit of an internal check-in with yourself and just notice if and where you're bristling at the idea that we might have shared values, because we certainly know people in the world today with whom we would say we have absolutely nothing in common. I think it's important to remember that Elshtain is writing at the end of the period sociologists named postmodernity, and I'm not sure we're in whatever has come after, but during that period of postmodernity, a whole lot of relativity got introduced into the conversation so that truth became relative. Well, that may be your truth, but, well, you know, we have to, what she's saying is what we need. That's why I think, you know, she refers to the need to repair it, right?
Yeah.
That we need to repair. We need to, you know, remember what it means to be American citizens, to be bound to an ideal and, you know, not an ideal, I would argue, that we've ever hit, though we've seen glimpses of it. But do we still agree on the ideal? Do we still agree what it means to be an American citizen? Do we still agree that what is democracy and is it something that we want to preserve? Because it seems to me that there's a whole slew of Americans who would be very happy to just flush democracy and allow an autocrat to move in and take over so long as he kicks all the asses of the people they want kicked. Yeah. So, you know, you and I have talked about this ad nauseum. We're not even in the same realm anymore with respect to what is real, right? There's over 65% of his supporters still believe that the election was stolen. How do we begin to repair that breach? How do we begin to get to it when we cannot even agree on the positive statement, i.e. the table is brown? Do you know what I mean? We can't even get to that, much less the normative.
Yeah. So a couple of responses to that. I think it's appropriate and maybe too easy to simply go to the Trump thing. I feel like that.
Well, it's illustrative.
It is illustrative, but it's been building for a while. Like, there are underlying currents in our culture. Elshtain, we've said it a million times. She wrote this 24 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. So
pre 9/11.
So if we focus too much on Trump and he does suck in our attention, I get sucked into it. But I want to try to see what's underneath that. And there's a lot underneath it.
There's a lot of really pissed off working class people
for whom
this American dream was sold. They did what they were told, and now they're getting screwed. And yeah, they're pissed, and I get it. I totally get it.
So that's not to excuse what's going on, but I think that kind of analysis is more helpful.
Yeah.
Because it gets part of why that analysis is more helpful is I think it gets again to the what is the human need that has been ignored for so long, and I don't mean for us to answer this question.
Three words. I'm going to answer the question in three words. How's that? Okay. To be seen. To be seen. These people, I think the vast majority of them just feel that in this current cycle that they and their values have been swept under the rug and they are no longer seen. No, you didn't want to go there. Okay, well, where did you want to go, Chris?
That's so compelling that now I want to go there. We need to do a show on that very thing.
Okay.
Because it touches on the human need to belong, to have a sense of belonging, to be seen, to belong. Okay, but we're not going to go there. We're not going to go there. Where are we going to go? I wanted to respond to what you were saying about normative statements and the necessity of them. And there were so many ideas that I had in my head as you were talking, and it's hard for me to choose. Here's one. Let's see what happens with this one.
Right about now, you can hear it sounds like a breeze blowing through the room. It is, in fact, just air rifling through the ideas in Chris's mind.
Well, so here's the thing. We, our culture, this is an observation I will make, and be curious to have you help me fill this in and what I'm missing. It's not just that we don't talk about, let's just say, values, like what is good and what is not good. It's not just that we don't talk about those things. It's even more pernicious, which is I'm not sure we certainly don't know how to, but I'm not even sure that we've got the belief that it's possible to have conversations about values and about morality in our shared common life. Do you get that? Like, it's not, let me just pound on this one for a second.
No, you should stay there for a second because I'm trying, like, that was a really rich statement.
I mean, right. So you can imagine a society that has disagreement about values, but is at least able to have conversations about values. And so that means if you are able to do that, that means there is some ground on which to have the conversation. Like, you share some basic commitment to values talk, and you're not so caught in relativism that it is just meaningless talk, but rather you have a firm foundation and you believe in conversation like this, that conversation that can move towards a truer vision of what is good
our shared
common life.
Yeah.
So
before you go on to the second thing, let me just say that I think what has happened is that over time, conversation itself has picked up plaque, and the plaque weighs us down. So we never get free of the plaque in order to have that conversation. Instead, we're weighed down into the quagmire of who is right, who is wrong, what is this conversation going to cost me if we get to value, you know, because it has become, you know, not only do we just have a disagreement about an idea, but that disagreement equals person bad, you know, that, and not only person bad, person enemy, you know, and that is the state of conversation in our shared common life today. And that is the very thing that, you know, we're trying to clean some of the plaque off with the S1 project so that we can get back to those conversations. Yeah. But go ahead. You had a second point.
I wanted to tie that, what you just said, back to Elshtain a little bit, because democratic authority, that authority is not invested in one person. It's democratic authority. And so it's the authority invested in us, I think, to be able to have the conversations about visions of the good for our society that do not end in vilifying others and making enemies. And it's so there's a, you know, Elshtain's article is about, she doesn't say this, but it's about the virtues necessary to be able to have democratic conversation. And that is the common, like the quote that I read, unless citizens are able to repair to some shared political and normative vocabulary. So at the basis of democratic conversation is there's a value statement implicit in the ability to have conversations.
And right now there is like one of the things that is so disheartening for me is the extensive value that our economy has placed on people who are obnoxious, loudmouth, like the more outrageously horrible you are, the more money you make, right? That's the whole theory behind these online algorithms, that, you know, the more you're instigating fear, the more you're putting people down, the more money you can make. And since money is the golden calf in our culture, you know, people will go there and people will do whatever they can to make money. And they don't care. They don't care. I don't even know that they see what it's doing to the fabric of our common life together. But at some point, we need to revert from being consumers back to being citizens of this great nation. And somebody or some bodies need to begin speaking again the values that made America great. And, you know, I think I said this last time we were together, but if our listeners did not hear Chris Christie's speech when he canceled his campaign, you should Google it. Go back and listen to it. I swear to God, it was one of the most inspirational things I have heard from a politician on any side of the line since Barack Obama was president. You know, he went back to those core ideals. He lifted up those ideas about who we are as a nation and what it's going to take for us to get back there. It was inspirational. But those are the kinds of That's the way we need to be able to get back to it. I remember last spring, my buddy Dax and I were sitting out in my driveway, what I call redneck camping. The camper was in the driveway. We had the awning out. We were sitting out there drinking beer, playing cards or something. And, you know, I've got one of those We Believe signs out in front of my lawn. Some guy just like drove by and just like screamed something at us. I couldn't even understand what he was saying. And I kind of wanted to say, hey, buddy, I got a cooler full of beer. We got an empty seat. Why don't you come and let's have a conversation about it? Figure out where we agree and where we disagree. But you got to drive by my house and yell at me? This is where we're at. This is what we've sunk to. How do we begin to repair that to, as Elshtain calls us, to find the commonality when you've got that degree of hostility? Or worse, you know, people coming into your church with semi-automatic weapons and blowing people away because they just funded, because they believe in some conspiracy theory. We got some work to do.
Yeah, we do have some work to do. And the forces at work that are antithetical to, that are tearing at what I'm just going to call democratic virtue, the ability for us to be self-governing people. They're subtle in certain ways. Like, I want to circle, but I mean, it doesn't seem subtle to you, but it seems subtle to me, which is the moneyed interest in fanning online anger. Okay, let's just take that as
hostility,
anger, enmity. All of these things they just eat like acid at democratic a democratic self-governing people, at our ability, at our capabilities to be and to continue to be a self-governing people. Underneath that is a moral judgment. And I think that's what Elshtain really wants to call us to pay attention to, that we need to make the moral judgment that stoking anger in people just for a buck is bad. It's a bad thing to do because it doesn't promote human flourishing. It just promotes me lining my pocket with money because the algorithms work.
And to be clear, we're not talking about outlawing it, but encouraging people not to tune in, like to make it irrelevant by not buying it. But again, that is a rehabilitative process right now. We've got a whole culture we need to rehabilitate and to steer away from that stuff. And I don't know, that's the place at which it's like, well, you know, Elshtain says we've got to do this rehabilitative work. And I agree. Did she have a paper that followed this where she talked about how the hell we might actually do that?
You know, so that's a great segue that might point us towards the end of today's show, Shana, which is there's an educative piece that has to be part of this. So you and I get together, we do this podcast. That's good. And we have discerned in the S1 Project a need, a calling to have an educational component. So we are working towards developing how we're going to help other people think in ways and to act in ways that take into view the normative dimension of our shared common life. Now, and I would just add this, I believe, and it's actually a premise of our show that we say every time we begin, which is the lenses of humanistic learning will help us recover and deepen the normative, the moral vision, the moral underpinnings of being able to be self-governing people. So there are efforts. The Great Questions Foundation, I would just mention this to our listening community, they and others, there are other places doing this, they're basically reviving great questions kinds of pedagogy, which, among other things, encourages open-ended conversation with people with whom you might disagree on important questions like what is justice and what is democratic virtue? Like great, great big questions that are not easy to answer, but must be addressed.
Mm.
So there's an the short answer is there's an educational piece to this that's important, and we are addressing it.
Right. Right. Well,
are we there?
Stay curious, Chris.
Go deep, Shana.
And shine light. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another segment of What in God's Name, the podcast of the S1 Project.
You can support our work on patreon.com. Just go to Patreon and put in the search bar, What in God's Name. You can find us there. Join the growing community of people who are supporting our work. Shana, I'm so appreciative for this opportunity once again to think about these things and talk about them with you.
Thanks, Chris. You've again opened my heart, my eyes, and my head. So, got a lot to think about going forward. Have a great day.